Welcome to Defenders, the teaching class of Dr. William Lane Craig. Today, the Doctrine of Christ, Part 24. For more resources, including articles, books, podcasts, audio, and video, go to reasonablefaith.org.
In our lesson on the resurrection of Jesus, we've been talking about what is the best explanation for the evidence of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances of Jesus, and the origin of the disciples' belief that God had raised him from the dead. And last week, we reviewed a couple of objections to inferring what I call the resurrection hypothesis. And that is the hypothesis that God raised Jesus from the dead. That was the proclamation of the earliest disciples. God raised Jesus from the dead. And I call that the resurrection hypothesis. Now, some of us just glaze over when we see a mathematical equation. And I appreciate that. I still have a sort of lurking mathophobia that I have to struggle against. But I think this equation here is really very easy to understand. We're not trying to compute it, but just to understand it. What this is the probability calculus. And it shows why, in fact, these objections based on slogans like extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, or that no amount of evidence could ever establish a miracle, are, in fact, demonstrably fallacious. What we want to understand is the probability, and that's abbreviated by P, the probability of the resurrection hypothesis, and then you have this line that indicates relative to which that hypothesis is being considered. What is the probability of the resurrection hypothesis given the specific evidence, and that would be the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, the transformation of the disciples, and the background information, which is our general knowledge of the world, including the facts about the life and ministry of Jesus of Nazareth up until and through his crucifixion. So, given our general background knowledge of the world and the specific evidence in this case, we want to know what is the probability of the resurrection hypothesis compared with the negation of the resurrection hypothesis, that it is false that God raised Jesus from the dead, or God did not raise Jesus from the dead. Which is more probable, given the evidence and background information, the resurrection hypothesis or its opposite? That's what we're asking. And the probability calculus tells us that in order to compute that probability, we have to understand two other probabilities. The first is the intrinsic probability of the resurrection hypothesis. That is to say, if you leave out the evidence, just leave aside the evidence, bracket that, what is the probability of the resurrection just on the background information alone? What is the probability God raised Jesus from the dead if you just think about the general background information we have of the world and you bracket the specific evidence? What is the probability that the resurrection hypothesis is false, given the background information? Which is more probable relative to the background information, the resurrection hypothesis or its opposite? And then the other probability that we need to compute would be called the explanatory power of the resurrection hypothesis. That is to say, how well does this hypothesis explain the evidence? Given the resurrection hypothesis and the background information, how probable is it that we would have this evidence? That is to say, if, given the background information and the fact that Jesus or God raised Jesus from the dead, how probable does that make the facts of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief? And I think you can see that probability would be extremely high. That is to say, the resurrection hypothesis has great explanatory power. By contrast, if the resurrection hypothesis is false, if God did not raise Jesus from the dead, then what's the probability that we would have this evidence that we do of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the transformation in the disciples? So, this would be the explanatory power of the resurrection hypothesis. And what I tried to explain last time is that people like David Hume and others who are skeptical about identifying a miracle only focused on part of this calculus. In particular, they tend to focus on just the intrinsic probability of the resurrection. And they say, given the laws of nature, given what we know about what happens to dead people, it's extremely improbable that Jesus rose from the dead. Dead men don't rise again. So they would say that this resurrection hypothesis is enormously improbable intrinsically. And therefore, they conclude that the resurrection hypothesis is improbable given the evidence and the background information. That's obviously fallacious. You've got to also consider the other factors in the probability calculus. And even if the resurrection hypothesis is extremely improbable intrinsically relative to the background information alone, the probability or the explanatory power of the resurrection hypothesis could be so great that it would counterbalance any intrinsic probability in the resurrection. So that once you take into account the evidence, well, then this probability can be very high that God raised Jesus from the dead, given the evidence and the background information, even if this probability, the resurrection relative to the background information without any evidence, is very low. And I think that's intuitively obvious, don't you? I mean, just because something is improbable relative to the background information when you don't have any evidence, it doesn't follow that once you have the evidence that it remains improbable. Can you imagine in a court of law arguing that relative to our background information, it's highly improbable that someone is the murderer? But you abstract away all the evidence, the fingerprints, the ballistics, the eyewitness testimony, you abstract all that away and say it's highly improbable that Jones is the murderer. But that doesn't follow that it's highly improbable that Jones is the murderer once you insert the evidence. And so it's exactly the same way with the resurrection. Even if the intrinsic probability of the resurrection is very low, it doesn't follow that, therefore, the resurrection hypothesis is very highly improbable, because its explanatory power compared to its negation could easily outweigh any improbability in the resurrection hypothesis itself. Now, that was the first point I tried to make. Let me ask if there's any question or comment on that point before I go to the second point I tried to make. Does everybody understand why those who say just because a miracle is intrinsically improbable, therefore no amount of evidence can establish it, are mistaken? Okay, Ted?
Would almost have to be on something that is impossible or intrinsically impossible. If it's something that's ordinary, it would not be considered a miracle. So if you're looking at the miracle of, you know, of him being raised from the dead, they say, well, he wasn't raised. It's a miracle because of what happens, you know.
Well, that's David Hume's point. That's why Hume says that the resurrection is highly improbable, because a miracle, he would say, by definition, is a violation of the laws of nature, and therefore, by its very nature, it's highly improbable. Now, I want to...
One other point of that, though, is... Okay. So then if a person were to look back, you say, okay, well, how many... if you go back to parting of the Red Sea, all the other... The creation of everything from nothing, you know, if you get all the way back to that point, you know, everything God has ever done is a miracle. It's a miracle. Everything that God has done as far as what he's done about creating the world from nothing, speaking.
All right, but I mean, I don't like the way you're backpedaling here, Ted, because then you're making the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus hinge on things like the evidence for the parting of the Red Sea and all these other miracles, and you're going to just confront the same problem
with
them.
Well, what I'm just trying to make it is related to God. God is the cause of it.
All right, well, that I'm going to make that point in a minute, is I would agree that it's highly improbable relative to the background information that Jesus rose naturally from the dead. And that's what I think is correct in what you're saying. A miracle is something that is not capable of happening through the natural processes of nature. But that's not the resurrection hypothesis. I'm already making my second point, which I want to delay making. So let me just prescind from saying anything more at that point. I'll say something about that in a minute. Any other questions on this first point? Yes, right here. And remind me of your name again. Eric. Okay.
I was just going to note that I find it interesting that people like Hume are attacking the resurrection on virtue of his improbability. The reason we're impressed by it is because it's improbable. No one's arguing that it's not.
Well, again, I'm going to say something about that in my second point. But what Eric is saying is we can agree that the resurrection is highly improbable relative to the background information alone. And that's correct. We really don't need to dispute that point. Now, I am going to dispute it, but we don't need to, because as long as the explanatory power of the hypothesis is great, that can outweigh any intrinsic probability. So you're quite right in saying that it can be highly improbable if you abstract all the evidence away that God raised Jesus from the dead. And that doesn't say anything about the probability of that hypothesis once you factor all that evidence back in again. Yes, Bruce?
Some critics of miracles will say, well, they set up a straw man and knock it down. They view miracles as a suspension of the laws of nature, whereas miracles are a superseding of the laws of nature. Everything else continues to operate according to the laws of nature, apart from those specific miraculous situations.
Right, I think that Bruce is making a valid point here that I haven't tried to make, but you're quite right, Bruce, is that it is incorrect to characterize a miracle as a violation of nature's laws. Not at all. It is no more a violation of the laws of nature that God would raise Jesus from the dead than that I would, say, prevent a match from striking by removing the oxygen from the air or something of that sort. The laws of nature describe what will happen through natural factors so long as no intelligent agent is intervening. But once an intelligent agent intervenes in the situation, then the laws aren't violated, but you have, as you say, they're kind of superseded. There are new factors in play here. So it's not as though God violates the laws of nature in raising Jesus from the dead. It's that the laws of nature have in them the implicit condition, so long as no one interferes, this is what the natural course of events will be. And that's still true in the case of Jesus' resurrection. Yes?
Yeah, I see the arguments here depend upon the evidence. And I wonder how often the atheist just questions the evidence and says, well, your formulas are nice, but the evidence is irrelevant because it's...
This is one of the things that is most stunning about contemporary New Testament scholarship, and that is that the specific evidence that I have adduced, the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the Christian faith, are agreed to by the vast majority of New Testament historians. Remember, we saw that even Bart Ehrman agrees with the specific evidence. So even Ehrman agrees with the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' faith. Instead, he appeals to this Humean philosophical argument to try to stave off the inference to the resurrection. So certainly there are skeptical critics, that's right, who will deny the historicity of the empty tomb or some other feature of the evidence. But they are in the decided minority, which is just stunning to me. That's how credible these narratives are. Yeah, Drew?
I guess, is there a simpler way you could write out that equation? Because even now, like after years and years, I look at that thing and I feel like I'm being clubbed over the head with mathematical formalism.
Right, right.
And some people on the internet were saying the same thing. I mean, could you write out, like, probability of resurrection versus probability of evidence without resurrection? I mean, that would be basically
the
same thing.
Well, yes. Now, actually, this is the simpler formula. If you look at reasonable faith, I have a more complex formula for calculating the probability of R on E and B. But Timothy McGrew said to me, Bill, that's too complicated. He said, use this odds form. It's easier to understand and to see. And if I had an eraser, what one might do is just erase the bottom line, Drew, and then that would just give you the probability, you know, of the resurrection on the background information and the evidence on the resurrection. And then you would also calculate what's on the bottom line, and then you would compare them to each other. So if it's blinding, just look at the top part and then look at the bottom part. And you can see, really, it's only two things. It's only two things. What's the probability of the resurrection on our background information? And what's the probability of the evidence, thank you, given the resurrection hypothesis and the background information? So once you look at this long enough, you can see there's really only two things. It's not really that difficult. And the fallacy of those who say things like extraordinary events require extraordinary evidence is that they're not taking into account all of the factors. They're just focusing on how extraordinary the resurrection is relative to the background information alone. Let's see, Joe Mulpedill has a comment.
Bill, it seems intuitive that what you just said is true, that great claims require great evidence. Is there, a more practical way? It does take a lot of explaining, and you tend to lose the person in showing that that's not exactly... Do you have
Joe, I gave the illustration to try to convey this point of hearing an evening newscast announce the winning pick in the lottery. When the Georgia State Lottery winning pick is announced, there's a number that the news reads off that, when you think about it, is enormously improbable relative to our background information that should be the number that would be the pick. And yet we don't require extraordinary evidence to believe that that was the number pick. If we required extraordinary evidence, we would never believe the evening news when it reports the lottery pick, because the improbability of that number being chosen would just swamp the reliability of the news. Even if the news were 99.9% accurate, it would still be swamped by the improbability of that pick. So what theorists came to see is that, in addition to the intrinsic probability of the hypothesis, is you've also got to consider this. What would be the probability that number would be announced if, in fact, that were not the pick? If that weren't the pick, what's the probability that just that number would be announced? Well, that's extremely low, and that outbalances any improbability in the thing itself. Elizabeth.
In a situation where you could have several explanations for, given a set of evidence, if you have several explanations for what happened and all of them are relatively high or relatively equal to each other, how do you account for the other explanations in that formula?
Okay, this is a good question. What Elizabeth, I think, is seeing is that not R here is not a monolithic thing. Not R includes things like the conspiracy hypothesis, the apparent death hypothesis, the hallucination hypothesis, all of these other explanations of the resurrection that we looked at, so that the value of not R would be the sum of the probability of all of these other things put together. So you could calculate the probability of the resurrection versus, say, the conspiracy theory separately if you wanted to. But what I did here was just simply sum them all together. But you're quite right in saying that there's a whole raft of these things that are comprised by not R. Yeah, Tom, over here.
Your example of the lottery seems a little unsatisfying to me for some reason. I'm not sure I can articulate it exactly, but it seems like we all expect some number to come up. So the fact that one does come up doesn't seem all that unusual. It seems like the better example might be that a golf ball popped out with a number on it or something, not a ping pong ball. You know what I mean? That some really unexpected thing came out.
Well, some number must come down the chute unless the machine malfunctions, but nevertheless, any number that comes down will be enormously improbable. So you are observing an event of extraordinary improbability. It's not miraculous. That's true. It's not something that can't happen by nature, but nevertheless, when you see that, you're observing something that is, the odds against it are like millions and millions and millions to one. So why should you believe this report on the news that that happened? That is like testimonial evidence to a highly extraordinary event. And you don't require that the testimonial evidence also be extraordinary in order to believe that event. Why? Well, because of what I just explained. Yes, down here. Jim?
Something a current event this Anthony woman in Florida that's been tried for killing her daughter now. If you substitute that situation in your middle equation there, the probability of a mother killing her child, that's just almost unheard of.
Yeah.
But then if you go back and you bring in the evidence for that, substitute everything out, that's better. I think that would, to me, that helps me to understand it better than the lottery deal.
Okay, well, that's a very nice example, I think. Jim's saying, relative to the background information, what's the probability that Casey Anthony would kill her daughter relative to just the background information about mothers and daughters? Well, it's probably pretty low, right? But given the evidence of the glowworms in the trunk and the larvae and the smell and other things, maybe it's highly probable that she actually did do this thing. So that relative to the evidence in the background information, now it becomes highly probable that she's guilty. That would be a good example. Okay, any other comment or question? Let's see. Yeah, Steve.
To me, it seems like if you remove the background information from the line, it still means the same.
Often, Steve, this formula will be presented without making B explicit. B will just be tacit. It'll just say, what's the probability of R? And the B won't be made explicit. But I put it here explicitly because I think it is helpful to see that probabilities are never absolute. Probabilities are always relative to some body of information that you're considering. But you're right, very often the B will just be left out.
Taking it out, it makes it clear that if the evidence you offer was that he was on the 11 o'clock news that he won, is one thing, whereas if the evidence was, well, he really wanted to win, it means nothing. And so it points out that it's the probability of the E in relationship to R.
Pardon me?
The probability of resurrection given the evidence is equal to just the plain probability of resurrection times the probability of the evidence if there was a resurrection.
Well, you still have to consider the probability of R in and of itself. You can't get away from that. You don't need to write B explicitly, but you will still then compare the probability of R to the probability of not R. That has to be factored in. Okay, some other question. Let's see. Let's go to someone before we return to the same person. So Michelle here has a question.
Hi, Mark. I also like the court case example a little better than the lottery, because I was reading Reader's Digest last month, and they made a comment about a woman who was suing the state or in the TV station because they did post the wrong lottery number.
Oh, really?
Yes. I'm going to assume it's probably the reposting, not the live episode, with pop balls up.
So it can't happen.
Yeah. So
it's not absolutely.
So the presupposition
impossible.
Is that you're watching it live.
Yeah. Okay, Eric.
Using this kind of lottery logic, that a certain event is highly improbable because it requires a series of events that are each in of themselves somewhat improbable. Wouldn't that make pretty much any event in history almost infinitely improbable, just because each event requires a very, very specific lead-in events? So that if you multiply the probability of every single lead-in event coming up, you get anything being
right.
Almost impossible.
Yeah. So you would probably not do it that way. you would just consider, for example, what's the probability of war between Pakistan and India, say, and you wouldn't calculate all the infinite number of events that had to lead up to the situation that one has. You would just take the background information you have, and then the hypothesis, and then consider what evidence there is for it, rather than this kind of piecemeal approach. In fact, that's kind of like planning as problem dwindling probabilities, which we also talked about last week, and said the fallacy was that he failed to remember that at each stage, new evidence is introduced so that the probability can actually increase with the introduction of the new evidence. All right, any other comment? I think Mark had a question or comment.
Thanks. Glad you mentioned planning, because my comments on that and also what you just wrote on the board about not resurrection. There may be some skeptics who like Plantinga's argument because it seems to argue in their favor. However, accounting for what you just wrote on the board about not resurrection, if you use Plantinga's argument for not resurrection, then you'd have to multiply all the probabilities of all the other counter ideas about the resurrection together, and then they also have the same problem with the diminishing probabilities.
Yeah, I remember in McGrew's response to Plantinga, he had a very elaborate tree diagram of the different probabilities that would have to be taken into account. And it was, I can no longer bring it to mind from memory, but there were a lot of other factors that needed to be considered at each sort of fork in the road as this tree unfolds. All right, now that's the first point I wanted to make against this Humean argument that says that we can never have enough evidence to make it probable that some event is a miracle or that a miracle has occurred. The other second point that I wanted to make is to challenge this assumption that the probability of the resurrection on the background information is very, very low. It seems to me that we're not in a position to say that the resurrection hypothesis is highly intrinsically improbable. What's highly improbable is the hypothesis that Jesus rose naturally from the dead, that all the cells in his body just spontaneously came back to life again. And I agree, that is enormously improbable. Conspiracy theories, apparent death theories, hallucination theories, all of those I think would be more probable than that Jesus would just naturally rise from the dead. But that's not the hypothesis. The hypothesis is that God raised Jesus from the dead. And so that probability, as I said, is going to rely upon two further probabilities. How can we compute the probability of the resurrection on the background information? Well, this is going to be the product of the probability of God's existence on the background information times the probability of the resurrection given God's existence and the background information. That is to say, the probability of the hypothesis, God raised Jesus from the dead, given the background information, is going to be computed by the probability that God exists, given the background information, and then the probability that if God exists, he would raise Jesus from the dead. And I think the probability of God's existence on the background information is very high. As I said before, this is the whole project of natural theology, the ontological, the cosmological, the teleological arguments, the moral argument for God's existence. All of those go to try to show that this probability is very good. Now, what is the probability then, given that God exists, that he would raise Jesus from the dead? Well, I don't see how you could say that's low. You may not be able to say it's high, but if your background information includes the life and ministry of Jesus, his radical claims, his miracles, his exorcisms, his trial, I don't see how anyone can say with any confidence that it's improbable that God would raise Jesus from the dead. And so I just don't see any reason to think that this probability, that is to say, the probability of R on B, is very low. I think, at worst, you'd have to be agnostic about it. And you can't say that that's low. And therefore, again, the argument fails because the whole argument against miracles depends on saying that this intrinsic probability of the resurrection is extremely, extremely low. And I don't think that we're in a position to say that. And the reason is because I think we've got good grounds for believing that God exists and that it's not improbable that he would raise Jesus. Okay, any question on that second point? Joe.
You know, I was talking to Mike, and he was remembering in his debate with, I think it's first or second, I can't remember which one, debate with Ehrman. They were talking about just the second point.
Oh,
you were discussing, uh-huh. And Ehrman in the Q&A or in their dialogical interaction said, yeah. Look, Mike, if I move it to walking on water, a billion people could walk out across the lake and fall in. And he said, yeah, but if my son's 1,000,000,001 and I hold his hand as he walks across the lake, then, you know, if we're talking about an external agent here,
yes,
that can either suspend or support, whichever way you want to put it there, and it does significantly change the equation.
So, and what did Ehrman say in response?
Well, everybody just was laughing or whatever, and he just threw his hands in the air. So
yeah. And what's funny about that, Joe, is that Ehrman, as a historian, or putative historian, cannot say that the probability of God's existence on the background information is low, because he says historians can't say anything about God. So he cannot argue that this is low. And yet that is going to determine whether or not the probability of R on B is low. So he's really worked himself into a dead end. Elizabeth.
I think that the reason people, they just kind of, it's like a knee-jerk reaction to the probability of something incredible like a resurrection from the dead happening. It really is just reactionary to the fact that it's uncommon, not
yes,
that it's improbable. Because if you look at, based on the background information of Jesus' ministry, it is highly probable that God, knowing what we know about God, would raise his son from the dead in order to further his plan. It is not very probable that God will resurrect half of our people who ever die.
Right.
You know, just normally making it a common event that things are, that people are resurrected. But the probability that God will resurrect, you know, this squirrel that just got run over is very low, however sad that is.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's not improbable so much as uncommon.
Very, very nice. You can't get any better than that. And what Elizabeth has served to draw our attention to is the religio-historical context in which this event occurs, or allegedly occurs. It's not like the squirrel on the highway. This is an event that occurs in the life, or as a climax to the life, of Jesus of Nazareth, who claimed to be the absolute revelation of God, who performed miracles and exorcisms in attestation of that fact, and it was crucified for claiming to be the unique Son of God and the promised Son of Man. So that provides a religio-historical context that is pregnant with significance, and I think, as you say, makes it not at all improbable that God would raise Jesus. Let me move on from there then. This was all by way of review, but I think it's been helpful in clarifying why those who would block the resurrection hypothesis, who would cut it off at the knees before you can even consider it, are reasoning fallaciously. So now we have to ask ourselves, well, is the resurrection hypothesis, in fact, the best explanation of the evidence? And surprisingly, I don't use Bayes' theorem, that's what this is called, or the probability calculus, to argue for that. Historians generally don't use the probability calculus. Why? Well, because many of these probabilities are what is called inscrutable. That is to say, you just don't know. For example, what is the probability that God, if he existed, would raise Jesus from the dead? Well, how can you put any kind of value on that? I think we can say you can't show that it's low. Elizabeth thinks it's pretty high, but there really isn't any way to put solid numbers to these probabilities. They're really rather inscrutable in some cases. And so historians generally don't use the probability calculus when they weigh historical explanations or hypotheses. Rather, as the historian C.B. McCullough, in his book, Justifying Historical Descriptions, explains, historians have a number of criteria that they apply for determining what is the best explanation. And there are six of these that I want to highlight. And I think that the hypothesis, God raised Jesus from the dead, passes all of these six criteria. The first criterion is that the hypothesis has great explanatory scope. Explanatory scope. That is to say, the hypothesis will explain all of the relevant evidence, not just part of it. And you may recall that we indicted some of the other hypotheses competing with the resurrection hypothesis because of their narrow explanatory scope. Remember, for example, the hallucination hypothesis tries to explain the postmortem appearances, but it does nothing to explain the empty tomb. So it has narrow explanatory scope. So the best explanation will be the one that has broad explanatory scope. Second criterion will be explanatory power. That is to say, how well does it explain the evidence? And we saw that that does feature in this probability calculus. That is to say, given the hypothesis, does it explain well the evidence that we have? Thirdly would be, is it plausible? Plausibility. Would it imply a number of false beliefs if this hypothesis were true, or is it plausible given the context? And here I would argue that, as we said, the resurrection of Jesus is very plausible given its religio-historical context. Fourth would be that it is not ad hoc or contrived. Ad hoc is Latin for meaning to this. And the idea of something that's ad hoc is a hypothesis that is contrived. It's made up just to explain this specific thing. There's a certain artificiality about an ad hoc hypothesis that speaks against it. And the resurrection hypothesis, it seems to me, is not ad hoc in that way, given the existence of God established by natural theology. It seems to me perfectly natural to say that God would raise Jesus from the dead. Number five is that it's in accord with accepted beliefs. Accord with accepted beliefs. Now, someone might say here, but the resurrection is not in accord with accepted beliefs. It's an accepted belief that men do not rise from the dead, and the resurrection says Jesus rose from the dead. But again, I think we need to be careful. What the accepted belief is that people don't rise naturally from the dead. There's nothing in the laws of nature that would bring somebody back from the dead. And the Christian agrees with that. We agree that it is extraordinarily, impossibly improbable that Jesus would come back to life just naturally. But that's not the resurrection hypothesis. That is that God raised Jesus from the dead, and that's not in conflict with accepted beliefs. And then finally, number six would be that it outstrips its rivals in meeting conditions 1 to 5. It outstrips rival hypotheses in meeting conditions 1 to 5. And one of the things that is striking about the resurrection hypothesis is when you compare it to its competitors, it really outstrips them in explanatory power, explanatory scope, plausibility. And therefore, none of these other alternative explanations has generated a large following among contemporary scholars. Most of these alternatives are defunct and have no followers at all today. So that those who deny the resurrection hypothesis are pretty much typically left with no explanation at all. They just say, we don't know what happened to Jesus. But they don't really have an explanatory alternative. The resurrection hypothesis, I think, by almost all accounts, far outstrips any of its rivals. And so those who reject it are simply left with no explanation at all. So it seems to me that on the basis of these criteria, that we can infer that the best explanation of the facts is that God raised Jesus from the dead. Question, Joe?
Could you delineate between number 3 and number 5, please?
Yeah, in Reasonable Faith, I give a more detailed account of that, Joe, that I didn't give here today. Let me just look at my notes. For plausibility, this is the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the hypothesis compared to the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the falsity of the hypothesis. It's the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the hypothesis compared to the degree to which accepted knowledge implies the falsity of the hypothesis. That would be number 3. And number 5 would be that if you add the hypothesis to accepted truths, then fewer falsehoods result. If you add the hypothesis to the body of accepted truths, fewer falsehoods would result. So those are kind of close, but that would be technically how one might differentiate those. Yeah, George?
Bill, C.S. Lewis says in Mere Christianity that he thinks Christianity is true because it has the, quote, ring of truth. It's not the kind of thing somebody would make up. He compares it to the truth about the solar system. Astronomy. You know, before people could observe, they made up these theories that now, you know, don't make sense. We know they're false. And the actual facts are not the kind of thing people could invent.
Uh-huh.
And in the Jewish and Greek cultures where Jesus was ministering in Paul, you know, Paul says that the resurrection and the preaching of the cross is foolishness to the Gentiles and a stumbling block to the Jews.
Right.
So it seems like it's unlikely that he would invent that or make it up. Is that another criteria that you would perhaps add to your list?
No, actually, where I think that point would fit in very nicely, George, is in establishing the third piece of evidence, namely that the disciples came to believe that God raised Jesus from the dead. Because that is not something that they would in all probability have come to believe, either from a Jewish point of view or from a Gentile point of view, for exactly the reasons that you mentioned. So that I would see as part of the evidence establishing that third fact.
The copyright for the content of this recording is held by Dr. William Lane Craig. For more, go to reasonablefaith.org.